Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Joining me on the show today, we have the good folks from MSF, or Médecins Sans Frontières, also known as Doctors Without Borders, which provides medical assistance to people affected by conflict, epidemics, disasters, or exclusion from healthcare. I have Paul Brockman, Regional Director of Doctors Without Borders, and also Dr. Mohana Amitharaja, Deputy Medical Director of the Operational Centre Amsterdam, which is a cooperation between MSF UK, German, Holland, and South Asia. Thank you both for being on the show today. Thank you for making time to, while you're on the trip here to Malaysia. Maybe we could begin there. Tell us a little bit about your respective roles in MSF, but also what brings you to Malaysia this time around, Paul?
Brilliant. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having us today. And it's really an honor to be here and have a chance to speak with you and your audience about this. As you said, we can call it regional director. Formally, I'm an operations manager, but functionally what that means is I'm responsible for all of our activities here in Malaysia and for our activities in Myanmar and Bangladesh. So I've got this regional portfolio, and I also work and am responsible for our activities in Iraq and Nigeria.
Okay.
This is my second time visiting Malaysia as the person responsible for supporting what we do here. And as you may know, and we can certainly talk about, I hope, more today, one of the aspects of what we do in this region, and specifically what we focus on here in Malaysia, is how to better meet the very significant humanitarian medical needs of Rohingya refugees in all three of these countries that I'm responsible for in this region.
Okay. Dr. Mohana.
Hi. Thank you for having us. So I'm an orthopedic surgeon by background, but I've been with MSF since 2014. So as a deputy medical director, I cover the medical portfolio globally. Mm. So not just the regions that Paul covers, but the regions that are covered by the Operational Center in Amsterdam. This is my first time in Malaysia, so very happy to be here. And yeah, we are here to talk about our work with the Rohingya and what we see from our beneficiaries here in Malaysia.
Well, so let's talk about the Rohingya refugee crisis. It's been more than, I think, 6 years now, hasn't it, since 700,000 Rohingya fled targeted persecution in Myanmar. And I'm just wondering, I mean, none of us could have expected that this has become a protracted crisis. Could you, Paul, maybe give us a little bit of background as to the evolution of the crisis until today?
Yeah, so the Rohingya, for anyone that doesn't know, the Rohingya are a relatively small ethnic minority in the state of Rakhine, which is sort of southern central Myanmar, right on the border with where it touches Bangladesh a little bit. And MSF first started working with Rohingya populations in Rakhine in 1992-93. Having started our work in Myanmar just within the last couple of years before that. One of the things, so at that time there was a very significant other earlier wave of very targeted, very significant violence that mostly focused in central Rakhine. Mm-hmm. At that time, an awful lot of Rohingya were really affected throughout central and northern Rakhine. Previously, Rohingya had been relatively integrated in communities, mixed both Buddhist and Muslim ethnic Rakhine and Rohingya and others all working relatively well together, is my understanding. I wasn't there at the time. So we've been working in both Bangladesh and Myanmar since then. Mm. We've now been present in Malaysia for nearly a decade. And here our work is exclusively focused on Rakhine in Malaysia, on Rohingya. In Malaysia, we work in several different regions and have stayed present in several different regions, including, for example, Kachin in the north and other parts, Yangon in the center and other places. Bangladesh, again, we've worked in many different regions over the years, but we've maintained sort of a permanent presence focused on this significant Rohingya problem since 1992. Speaking about 2017, that was the most extreme and quite an unprecedented level of violence in northern Rakhine, specifically around Mongda and other townships in northern Rakhine near the border. It was shocking. It shocked us in Myanmar. It shocked us in Bangladesh. It shocked the global community that saw what was happening then. And at that time, we scaled up our response massively in Bangladesh because it went from having some relatively smaller refugee camps with populations in the 50 to 100 to 150,000 range to now hosting the world's largest refugee camp. And as you said, this has become a sustained crisis without a solution.
What is it like in Cox's Bazar? As you said, it's the biggest refugee camp, the world's biggest refugee camp. I'm just wondering, what is it like now? 6 years. So it was meant to be temporary housing, but it's where people are languishing indefinitely. What is it like in Cox's Bazar?
Well, my first impression when I first worked in the camps in late 2018 was it's not that bad in some ways. I've worked in a lot of refugee camps in other settings. But I think it's the sustained nature of it. I mean, any community you're going to see children playing. Any community you're going to see parents and neighbors speaking with each other. You do see that in the camps. But in the years that I've been going there, which is now pretty consistently since 2018, there's an increasing sense of listlessness, desperation, lack of hope that I sense when I'm on the streets and walking around the camp. And what we hear from our medical staff that work in our multiple hospitals and clinics spread across all of the camps is from all of our patients an increasing sense of feeling trapped, not having a future, not having hope, being ignored and forgotten by the world. And I think that's part of why Mohana and I are here now. We're supporting the activities we do right here in Malaysia. B, we're trying to better understand how we can strengthen our support to communities and our partnership with partner governments, organizations, NGOs, the UN system, anyone that can help provide both short and long-term improvements for this community.
Dr. Mana, can I bring you into this conversation? In terms of the pressing health challenges that Rohingyas face at Cox's Bazar and in containment in Bangladesh, but also when they make that terrifying sea trip. Let's focus in Bangladesh first. What are the concerns, particularly as we're hearing stories about food rations being cut to $8 a month? I think that works out to be about 6 cents per meal or something to that effect. How does that impact the health and well-being of Rohingyas in living in containment in Bangladesh?
Yeah. So I was in the camps. I was working in the camps during the big exodus several years ago. And of course, at that time, you're treating people for acute trauma, psychological trauma, physical trauma, and of course, whatever injuries or effects they may have had on the journey. Now, of course, what you have is it's the biggest refugee camp in the world. So you have this mega camp, you have people in containment. You have a water sanitation system that is not kept up with the growth in the camp. And so you have all the difficulties that come with that. So including there's a giant scabies outbreak at the moment, which you can imagine just the sort of dehumanizing effect.
But what is scabies, if you can elaborate?
So scabies is basically, it's a type of insect, really, that causes a skin condition, a skin infection. And it's very difficult to get rid of. And it is associated primarily with poor hygiene and poor living conditions. And it's extremely uncomfortable, and it causes skin rashes and irritation that's quite visible. So you have the secondary health effects of water sanitation. Of course, whenever you have a large group of people living in close quarters, you have all the infectious disease problems that come with that. And then, of course, you have the same conditions that any population has. You have women giving birth, children who get typical childhood illnesses. Of course, with this population, like other populations in South and Southeast Asia, you have a certain level of non-communicable diseases, diabetes, heart disease, etc. And what we struggle with a bit in the camp is we, as MSF, provide about 40% of the health care in the camp. It is not enough, so we need other actors to help us out. And of course, in the beginning of the crisis, you had lots of actors coming in. You had quite some dedication even from the Bangladeshi authorities to let people operate. And of course, both the funding and the interest has waned over the years. So in the camps, we provide primary care and we provide secondary health care, but only up to a certain level. For example, as MSF, we don't provide surgery. So we're dependent on other actors to take our surgical patients. We do a lot of antenatal care, and we do normal deliveries, and so we try to give women really good antenatal care so they don't get to the point of needing an emergency cesarean section. And then, of course, in terms of the food rations and malnutrition, yes, of course. I mean, you have a population that has no ability to earn a livelihood. So this year in our outpatient clinics, for example, we've seen malnutrition rates that are close to 24%, which is quite high. So we're concerned about all the ongoing medical effects that can happen when people lack nutrition.
So you mentioned over time there's waning interest, waning maybe funding even. And I mean, I think it's kind of understood that attention goes to the most recent conflict. And here, I mean, I think the war in Ukraine also competed with funding and attention. Now we have significant focus on the conflict in Gaza. How do you balance that in your humanitarian work, trying to ensure that there is sustained interest and sustained resources for a refugee crisis that has become protracted over 6 years? Paul and Mohana, both of you.
I'll go first, and then you're the global one, so I'll let you talk about balancing it across the whole portfolio. I mean, even within my own portfolio, as you heard, I've got three countries in the region with a very sustained commitment that's very important for us. I mean, MSF's direct investment of our self-funded projects in this region over the years has been, you know, getting closer to 200 million since 2017 in these three countries for Rohingya facing programs, something like 180 million euros at this point. So I've inherited this portfolio, and I feel a commitment to the people that came before me and that come after me and sustaining how well we do this. Mm-hmm. I'm also responsible for what are some increasing needs in Nigeria and for doing what we can in the other countries of my own portfolio. Mm-hmm. And then as MSF, we face a lot of crises globally. That's a really good question, you know, and I think what a lot of my friends and family and community members say is, why is it so complicated? Every country has its own complexities. Mm-hmm. Myanmar itself is a very complicated situation. The Rohingya are a small minority from a complicated country that evades simple solutions. There's not a one-stop, one easy fix for this. And I think that part of why we're here now is, well, one thing, we've just launched this wonderful video, which I think you've already seen. It's not wonderful. It's beautiful.
It is beautiful.
And it's really moving, and this is a new effort for us.
It's a short animated video that depicts the plight of a Rohingya man who's making that treacherous journey through the seas.
Yes. And so he fled for his life in fear of violence about a decade ago, a bit more than a decade ago, I think. And
it's a real life story.
It's a real life story, a man named Muhib. And he told our staff in Penang, where we do clinical work specifically with refugees and mostly Rohingya in Penang City. He told that story 3 years, 3.5 years ago. And it really captured the imagination of our own teams. And they said, how do we create a little more sentiment of fellow feeling and sympathy and fellow humanity with Rohingya? And they said, they went to our desk, my predecessor at that time, and said, maybe we could make a video or do a story about it. And it turned into this animated video, which we think is beautiful and which we hope will, particularly at this time of year, spark the minds and imaginations of people to remember we're all human, and how would I react in that situation? And again, it's really, it's not right and it's not human to rank crises, the best, the worst, the most important. But a lot of what we do in MSF is to try to draw attention to forgotten crises and to neglected populations around the world. And I think that that's part of what we're trying to do here, is remind people that even as these other new crises erupt, this population has been rendered, due to their statelessness, due to Myanmar's depriving them actively of citizenship rights and protections that we take for granted. They've been rendered dependent on aid. It's not a choice they've made. This is a situation they're trapped in.
They can't work, so they can only wait for aid, dwindling aid, if I might add. Dr. Mohana, could you weigh in on maybe the global perspective? How do we ensure that there is sustained attention on, as Paul mentioned, forgotten crises?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think in that sense, we are quite fortunate as an organization because we are present globally. So, for example, we were present in Ukraine before the conflict. We were present in Gaza before the conflict. And, you know, we were present in the camps in Bangladesh before the big influx of refugees. And as you can see, we will be present in all those places, you know, after they fall out of the news. And we're very lucky in that we have a large donor base that trusts us to work around the world and to work in areas that don't make the news every day. Mm. And we definitely bring that vulnerability lens to it. So we look at populations that are vulnerable, the ones that you do hear about and the ones that you don't hear about. And this is evidenced by the fact that the vast majority of MSF patients are children. So around 70% of our patients are children. The remaining adults are mostly women. And I think part of the way that we bring attention to these places is our sustained commitment to be in a lot of these places and to be in these areas of the world and to serve populations where we know that there's no a solution in the near term, you know, to end that vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And we try consciously to look at creative ways, such as the Lost at Sea video, you know, to humanize these populations, to bring them back into the mainstream media. And you know, what part of our logic for making this animated video is to really introduce this crisis to maybe a younger set of people who, yeah, you know, who weren't paying attention 5 or 6 years ago, and to understand that there's a lot of vulnerable groups, you know, besides what they already hear about from Gaza.
So what's been making headlines recently has been the 1,000 or so Rohingya refugees who've made that journey across the sea and have landed in Aceh in Indonesia. Can we talk a little bit about what may be seen as quote-unquote sailing season for Rohingya refugees? You talked about the listless, desperate situation in Cox's Bazar. Maybe that's pushing a lot of refugees to take the risky journey. How do we think about that? I mean, the video was wonderful in kind of showing what this man went through in his sea journey. But what does a Rohingya refugee go through when they say, I would rather risk my life in the sea, on the seas, than stay here any longer?
I think that's a good question. If I can, I'll give a bit of an answer. And then I think Dr. Mahan has a few very specific things around the medical risks.
Yeah.
And I think everyone that I've spoken with, whether in the camps or in Rakhine or here after they've landed, says, you know, this is a journey that I didn't take by choice. This is a journey that I took in the hope of some sense of a future for myself or my family or my children. A lot of the parents that we speak with in the camps say, we wanted our children to have some kind of future, so they have to pay often smugglers or other people to help the kids get out, and often it's young girls these days that are being married. And I don't think these are choices any parent makes lightly or if there are other choices available. And one of the things that we're trying to do, you know, I mean, Dr. Mahana has the ability to actually clinically face patients and help them directly, clinically, medically get better. I think as MSF, we want also to really have conversations like these and find tools that help humanize the populations and sensitize governments, policymakers, and neighbors, you know, host communities in all these places, to think about what they do in a similar situation, mm-hmm. to think about what they could do to help find interim and long-term solutions for communities at risk like the Rohingya and others.
Dr. Mahana.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing people have to keep in mind is that, you know, when you're stateless and you have no documentation, you have no choice in terms of movement except to use illegal migration routes, right? Because there is no quote-unquote legal migration route. And I think that the fact of being stateless excludes you from things like education, employment, but also medical care. And, you know, of course, yes, there's some medical care available in the camps, but it's not adequate. And again, there's no foreseeable future out of the camps. In Myanmar, this is a population that's still faced with ongoing violence. I think it's not a choice people undertake lightly. And then in terms of, what we're looking for, and we understand the definitive solution, of course, for the Rohingya tragedy will lie in Myanmar, but none of us, including the Rohingya people, foresee that coming anytime soon. So what we're looking for is to just make their pathway a bit easier in the countries where they do physically exist, understanding that no single country in the region can solve it alone.
Are there challenges to providing healthcare, medical care to Rohingya refugees in the different countries? And Paul said that young girls are being pushed into marriage as a way of escape, which makes me think what life would be like for a stateless, adolescent, pregnant girl.
Yeah, exactly. If you look at, for example, if you take the population that we're seeing in our clinic here in Penang, 80% of the people we see in our primary care clinic are women and girls 12 years of age and older.
12?
And yes, and if you specifically look at the adolescents, so the WHO defines adolescents as between the ages of 10 and 19, but if you look at why adolescent girls are coming to our clinic, more than 50% are coming because they're pregnant. It's exactly as you said, it's hard to imagine a more vulnerable group, than a pregnant adolescent who, doesn't speak the language, is in a new country, is essentially entered into a new family via marriage. Our medical footprint in Malaysia is relatively light compared to, say, Bangladesh or Myanmar, of course. But Malaysia has the advantage of having a very well-developed and high-quality health system. So what we're looking for is actually solutions for both the documented and undocumented refugees here in Malaysia to access that health system in a way that's sustainable, both for the population and for the government of Malaysia. So we're looking at things like community-based health funds, for example, that the community could pay into to cover part of the co-payments. So, for example, registered refugees, 50% of their costs are covered once they're registered with the UNHCR. But that out-of-pocket cost is the non-citizen, non-resident fee.
But so that would mean they would need to work.
Exactly. And so these are the discussions that we've been having with the government here in Malaysia, is thinking of schemes whereby, this community could work, could earn some income, could essentially pool their resources to actually be able to fund their entry into the health system. Because what happens now is that because there's a fear both of being turned over to the immigration authorities and also a fear of being unable to pay, people don't really present into the health system until they're really desperate and really sick. And we know the costs of secondary health care or life-saving care are much higher than preventative care. So it actually creates this system that is actually more of a cost burden to the Malaysian healthcare system.
Okay, so that seems to be a kind of pragmatic way to provide some kind of short-term relief while maybe the long-term, more complex crisis needs to be addressed. Paul, in the couple minutes that we have left, tell me what MSF is hoping for, particularly in the short term, and how you're working with governments of the respective countries to maybe make life a little bit less vulnerable for these already most vulnerable, marginalized people.
So I'll start, and thank you for asking that question. I'll start at the level of the international community and its responsibility to provide stronger support, for example, to the Joint Response Plan, which is a humanitarian emergency fund for the camps. It's underfunded. The funding requests have been going down. They need to do better. The Rohingya did not put themselves in the situation. They've been trapped there. By the international community standards, donor governments should be doing more to support that camp population and the Rohingya and UNHCR with funding for third country relocation. So there's a great deal to be done there outside the region by countries to support this region in better responses. And then, as Dr. Mahana said, I mean, we've had some, I think, some really positive meetings with community service organizations, with an embassy or two, with some senior government offices and officials. And we sense a real openness to working on, as you said, pragmatic solutions. Mm-hmm. The long-term solution does need to be a safe, free, dignified return to Myanmar. But let's be realistic about that. And let's let the senior government officials work on that in their way. And in the meantime, come up with solutions locally in Malaysia, Bangladesh, elsewhere, and outside the region that support some interim solutions of sustainable, you know, dignity and self-control and self-determination for the Rohingya.
Both of you, thank you for coming and sharing your insights and highlighting this really important issue on the show. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's all we have for you on this episode of Consider This. I'm Alyssa Idris, signing off for the evening. Thank you so much for watching, and good night.